Wait, the chill comes back. Talk aside. We've been talking about Moetzet HaPoelot, the Women's Working Council. Well, in 1922, a 24-year-old American immigrant named Golda Meyerson took over that group, and we know her as Golda Meir today. I'm going to tell you a couple brief facts about Golda Meir, but we're only going to talk about this period because how she really comes to fame is not within our purview for this class, obviously. And prime ministership and ambassadorship and all that. In 1921, she and her husband moved to Kibbutz Merchavia, which is in the Emek, or the valley, up in the Galilee, or right next to the Galilee. Interestingly enough, at first her application for membership was rejected. Or their application for membership was rejected. I guess they ate some crow down the road. But then they reapplied and they were accepted. And the kibbutz quickly sensed her leadership ability, and they chose her to be their representative to Histadrut. Every kibbutz had a representative to Histadrut. In 1924, her husband was sick. The climate wasn't good for him there. So she moved to Tel Aviv, where they moved to Tel Aviv. It's so easy to say she because she's become such a dominating personality. And they have two children. Ultimately, they split up, even though they never divorced. She winds up raising the kids. In 1928, she is elected secretary of Moetzet HaPoelot. She was the leader of the council before, and now she's the leader of the whole thing. This is part of the various layers of leadership in these organizations. In January 1930, this might be a surprise to some of you who have been involved with Jewish organizations, but she was fed up with the infighting. So she decided to leave the leadership of the group, but she still stayed involved with Histadrut, and they wanted her to stay involved with Histadrut because she was such a leader. So in 1934, she's invited to Histadrut's executive committee. So now she's really up there. Who's the head of Histadrut at this point?
Ben-Gurion,
and he's also head of the Jewish agency, and soon he's going to become prime minister of the state. She eventually becomes head of its political department, which is an important post in these parties. And you know the rest of the story. So Golda Meir got her start in a women's organization in the land of Israel. And that is surprising to a lot of people because you don't think of her as an advocate for women's rights. Indeed, criticism has come down that she never really did anything for women's rights after that moment. But at that point, she led the organization and she really used it to climb her way up the Histadrut leadership. So one interesting feature of this era, and what I found to be the most fascinating, were the women's farms. Does anybody remember reading anything about any of the women's farms? Yeah, it was interesting, and they were meant to train women to go out to other places. A woman named Chana Meisels founded the first one in 1911, and it lasted for 6 years. And the goal was to have new immigrants come in and work on the farms and be trained in agricultural methods and be able to go out to the various kibbutzim and say, we have training now, because this was a problem. People were coming to the country full of ideology and vigor, yet they had no idea what they were doing. You had to train them somewhere, and the kibbutzim didn't want them trained on the job at that point. They wanted people who could obviously go out and work. So this was a very smart thing to do.
What were the training programs that were happening in Russia?
That came a little later. That was in the 1920s. That's called the Haksharot programs, and they were run by the various youth groups. Remember, most of Europe was tied up in the war from 1914 to ended in 1918, but then there was the rebuilding for a year or two, a couple years after that. So it's really in the early 1920s, and you start getting that with the third and then the fourth aliyah, but called the Haksharot is what it was called, which the preparation farms. The groups would come in, and they would go off. They would stay for about a year, and then they would settle new farms. And again, as I said, we wrote about them in The Plow Woman. Now, this didn't involve a tremendous amount of people or farms. There were 6 farms total, and there were 390 women at one time. But it was a nice feeder system for the kibbutzim. And it was also something that gave the women an opportunity to adjust to their life in the land of Israel, which was important for many of them. So it wasn't massive, but it was symbolic. That brings us... Yeah?
How long were they there? 2 years?
They were there for 6 years, from 1911 to 1970. 1 year. 1 year. And then they came again from 1921 for a few years through the 1920s. They had another version of them as well, called the Mishke Apollo, the women's working farms. Now we're going to get to the poet Rachel. I have a quote up there we're going to read at the end. The poet Rachel is one of the most celebrated women in Zionist literature, although she's not really that well known outside of Israel. It's interesting. But in Israel, you still read her poems in schools, and people take pilgrimages to her grave and they read her poems. Her poetry has been set to children's songs. So she really has a following in Israel. And you always know how great somebody is if they're known by just their first name, Rachel. So her name was really Rachel Bluestein, B-L-U-W-S-T-E-I-N. And she's really called the founding mother of Hebrew poetry. And in fact, the argument has been made that she's the first woman to write Hebrew poetry since Devorah in the Bible, since the judge, prophetess Devorah in the Bible. She lived from 1890 to 1931, so she had a brief life. She grew up in a little biography first. She grew up in a small town in Russia named Saratov. And then she moved to the Ukraine. Her grandfather was the Kiev community rabbi. Her father was a diamond and real estate merchant, so unlike most of the people that we've been dealing with, she's middle class, upper middle class. She went to a Russian-speaking Jewish high school. Then she went to a lower school. Then she went to an all-secular high school. She began writing poetry at the age of 15. At the age of 17, she moved to Kiev and studied painting. When she was 19, she visited Palestine with her sister Shoshana en route to Italy, and they were captivated. And so she decided to stay, as did her sister. They settled in Rehovot, which was a small town at that point with a lot of orchards outside of it, so they worked in the orchards. And Rachel eventually moved to Kibbutz Kinneret, which is Kibbutz Kinneret. There's really no difference, by the way, between a kibbutz and a kibbutz. Their name seems to change or be interchangeable around this time.
Is that where her grave is?
Yes, and there's a picture of that, I think, in the book. Either that or I saw it elsewhere. I can't remember.
We went on a women's trip together, mm-hmm. and Leslie Palmer has been.
Yes, she's sang
a lot of songs
that
have been made into songs.
Right, her poems have been made into songs, and her poems are. We're going to see a couple of them. They're short, but they're really beautiful. They're really nice, and we only see them in translation, so we don't get the multi-layered meaning of them. You know, in Hebrew, many words have several meanings. The Hebrew actually has one or two letters less in the alphabet, so there's a contraction in terms of the amount of words that you can make. What's it, one or two?
Letters?
Yeah.
Four
letters less?
I think so. I think it's 22 in Hebrew.
Okay. Shows you what I know. I can still sing it, but, you know.
I don't think it's counting the finals, maybe.
While she was at Kibbutz Kinneret, she worked at the Women's Agricultural School that was there, which we just talked about, one of the six. And she had a romantic relationship with Zalman Shazar, who would go on to become the third president of the state of Israel. So she shoots high. That's not a nice thing to say, sorry. All right.
He got lucky.
That's what I meant to say. In 1913, on the advice of Aleph Dalet Gordon, she went to France to study agronomy and drawing. War broke out and she was stuck in Europe. She couldn't get over to Palestine. So she went to Russia, where she taught Jewish refugee children, refugees from the fighting in Europe. While there, she suffered from poverty and a childhood lung disease came back. I'm not quite sure which lung debilitation she had, but it was very serious and ultimately it would claim her life. In 1919, she got on the first ship back to Palestine, the Ruslan. We talked about that. That's the one that brought 650 people over. It was the first ship of immigrants that came back after the war, and many of the leading people of the time were coming in on that ship, and it was really the equivalent of the Israeli Mayflower. She joined Kibbutz Degania, where she was diagnosed with tuberculosis finally. So what happened is eventually the kibbutz asked her to leave because they didn't want her around the children. Understandable at that time. She spent the rest of her life traveling around the country, based in Tel Aviv. She had an apartment there, but she didn't really make much money, but she traveled to see people and places and things. She translated things into Hebrew and translated things into French. She finally settled in a sanatorium for tuberculosis patients, and in 1931, at the age of 40, she died in Tel Aviv. What she left us mostly was her poetry. And most of that was written in the last 6 years of her life. And for a while, it was appearing weekly in the newspaper, Devar, which we've just mentioned a while ago, the Beryl Katz Nelson newspaper. What did she mean for Hebrew and poetry? We have this beautiful quote here. Rachel wrote poetry unencumbered by flowery language. She labored to invent new poetical language that was close to the spoken language and free of the residue of the scholarly textual culture of the Cheder, which is the traditional school. Her writings reveal a clear-eyed awareness of the fact that she was operating in a patriarchal cultural space that minimized and excluded women. She often wrote of her longing to be understood, of the feeling of insignificance, of a sick woman in a world that revered strength and power, and of the constant tension between the desire to be loved and the fear of the artistically destructive emotional and poetic price of love fulfilled. So I think that's a good capturing of what she meant. And now I'd like to share with you some of her poetry. There's a beautiful picture of her. Any volunteer to read? Anybody? Anybody? Don't make me choose.
But that's not the same as My Land, right? Yeah.
I'll read.
I was thinking the same.
Okay.
To My Land? Is that the one you want?
Yeah, To My Land.
I cannot offer you my land in praise, heroic deeds. One tree I planted on the way, which to the Jordan leads. One narrow path to my feet yields, which runs across the fields. I know how humble are the gifts the child offers her mother. A cry of joy one glorious day, when shines the sun in splendor, and shed for you a secret tear to see the shabby clothes you wear.
I think that's pretty good stuff. Again, it's in translation. Let's go for one more.
A couple more, I think.
Now that's her on Kibbutz Degania. And keep in mind the tense of the time before they put up the regular barracks. Any other volunteer to read?
To my country. I haven't sung to you, my country. I have not glorified your name with great heroic deeds or loot from the battlefield. My hands have simply planted a tree on Jordan's calm shores. My feet have simply formed a path through the fields. Indeed, a humble gift it is. I know this, Mother. Indeed, your daughter's offering makes a very humble gift. Only the thrilling cry of joy on the day the light will break through. Only my secret tears for you. For your present misery.
Any thoughts?
The idealism versus the reality of how harsh.
That's what she does, and that's one of the reasons why she's so popular. She doesn't just give you, you know, the this is great and wonderful and what have you. And remember, she knows she's dying, so that obviously puts a pall on everything as well. Let me see if I'm going to read this next one. Actually, I said I was only going to do one more, but. Keep in mind that she knows her fate.
It says in the book, this essay, that she only was writing this poetry when she was dying.
Right.
She wrote some beforehand.
She wrote some beforehand. But the vast majority was written in the last 6 years of her life. Remember, she started writing when she was 15 or 16 or something
right,
like that.
I think all of these...
Well, these might have been... Yeah,
poems
these...
That
yeah.
really deal with Aquas kind
right.
of issues.
Yeah, they're deep. Did you want to say something? No, I thought so. You move your hand. One gentle evening suave. One gentle evening suave. I'll go outside and immobile, not speaking to a single soul. I'll sit a while. I'll rest like one who seeks refuge from the Scirocco's heat in the shade of a leafy tree while sitting at its feet.
I shall pretend to have forgot that fate's decree assigned, which changes my few festive days to mourning predestined. One gentle evening suave, I'll go outside and immobile, not speaking to a single soul. I'll sit a while. I think it's really very incredible, introspective, reflective.
She must have endured great loneliness, because if she's rejected by Degania and told because she's ill and she can't work with children, and here she had been a teacher of children, and she's kind of isolated.
Yes, and in another poem she deals with not having a child to pass on a legacy. So she begins thinking about all that stuff as well. But she really resonates with people until today. So it's really...
Let me get her picture back up here, because it's a nice one to look at. I love this photo. I don't know how old she is in that photo. I can't decide if she's like 9 or if she's, you know, 25.
She has mournful eyes.
Yeah, it's very profound. Very profound. She's, yeah, it's the type of person that you would expect would be a poet. All right, that brings us to Henrietta Solt. A lot of you know a lot about Henrietta Solt because she is from Baltimore. And it's hard to believe that somebody, there's a picture of her in her later years, it's hard to believe that somebody who becomes so prominent in the founding of Israel was born back in 1860, the year before the Civil War started. But she lived a long and extremely productive life. In fact, she lived from 1860 to 1945, and you always feel a pang when you say, gee, if she lived 3 more years, she could have seen the state of Israel. That's very sad to me. She was obviously extremely bright. She too, unfortunately, would be limited in some regards, as we'll see, by the fact that she was a woman growing up in a men's world, although she sure did accomplish a lot. Her father was Rabbi Benjamin Solt of Temple Ohev Shalom, which was not where it is today. He was very liberal-minded when it came to women, which was to our great advantage because he molded her. She was the oldest of 8 children. From a young age, she was clearly very intellectual, as was her father. She learned from him German and Hebrew and scholarly texts. He wasn't afraid to show her scholarly texts. She was an 1877 graduate from Western Female High. High school diploma would be the highest degree that she would ever get. For 15 years, she taught French, German, and algebra at a private school, and she taught at Ohev Shalom's religious school, Hebrew school. She taught adults Torah and history. To further her education, she sat in on lectures at the Johns Hopkins University. She wasn't able to take classes, but she sat in there. In 1888, she was all of 28 years old. She was named one of the 9 members of the Jewish Publications Society's Publications Committee. So she would review the books and decide if they should be printed, and make rule decisions on that. She was the only woman on that committee, and she would serve on that committee for 2 decades. She spent a lot of time going back and forth between Baltimore and New York. In 1889, in Baltimore, she established the first night school for immigrants. Immigrants would come here, they wouldn't have the language, they wouldn't have the skills. She said, we have to do something about this. It was geared toward Russian Jewish immigrants, but it wasn't just Jews who took these classes. In 1902, she took classes at the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York City. But how she came to take those classes is interesting. It was known that they weren't taking women at the Jewish Theological Seminary into their classes at that time. She begged the president, Solomon Schechter, to let her study. He said, I'll let you study here under the condition that you don't try and seek rabbinical ordination. We're not going to do that. Which is something that people thought that she wanted to do. She agreed, and she helped translate texts and prepare manuscripts while she was there. She also had fell in love with Louis Ginsberg, who was the great Talmud scholar. Some of you might have heard of some of his works, Legends of the Bible and what have you. He was 15 years younger than her. He did not return her sense of love. He was married. It was a platonic relationship at best. And he really pushed her off. And this really hung over her for many, many years. Her Zionist career preceded Theodore Herzl's. In 1893, she was a charter member of a group called
Baltimore Chevres Sion. Does anybody remember when Herzl comes on the scene?
97.
That's when the Congress is. A couple years before that, he writes a book. 95. He writes Der Judenstaat, the Jewish state, in 1895. So she precedes him by 2 years. In fact, 1 month before Herzl's Jewish state comes out, she gives a speech, which we still have a copy of, where she talks about the need for the ingathering of the Jews in the land of Israel and a revival of Hebrew culture. So she anticipates Herzl and Echad HaAm all in one swoop. So she really had those major trends. She said they didn't need to compete. She maintains her active interest in Zionist affairs. She visits Palestine in 1902 with her mother and her sister, but still she hasn't started an organization. During World War I, she's the secretary of the Executive Committee for General Zionist Affairs. I jumped ahead of myself. 1912 is actually the year that she founds Hadassah. All right, she is not the only woman involved in the finding of it, involved in the founding of it. However, she quickly becomes the leader of the group. She founded it with 6 other women. She's the principal one. What's the one main goal of Hadassah when it gets started? Anyone know?
Hospital related.
Yep, upgrade healthcare in Palestine, and upgrade healthcare for all in Palestine. That's a particular thing of hers. Is it's not just going to be for Jews. It's going to be for everybody. She really felt that this would be the best way to energize American Jewish women. This would give them focus. It would get them, to raise their profile in the community. It would be very, very positive. The first project was a visiting nurses program in Jerusalem. They would bring the nurses over for a while. They would, you know, it's like going on a mission to a country in Africa where you're a nurse or a doctor and you check things and then you come home. Then after that, she did one with doctors. That was the second one. They set up a field hospital, and we know what the field hospital became, right? Hadassah. Became Hadassah Hospital.
It's a big trouble now. Major trouble now.
You know.
Crises come and go. We'll see what happens.
What's wrong with that financial
problem?
They're
in bankruptcy.
Early.
And mismanagement.
The Israeli government is saying they're not bailing them out. Yeah, really big trouble. It's like a huge scandal going on right now.
Netanyahu is a private economy guy.
Yeah.
He's not a social welfare guy.
The hospital is in bankruptcy. They actually had to take 1,000 patients out of the hospital.
Oof. Well, the staff has been on limited hours for weeks now.
Right, right.
They were striking because they weren't getting paid. I mean,
they haven't been paid in over a month.
It's striking because it's Israel.
Well, they haven't been paid.
Yeah.
The original Hadassah Hospital was...
Yes. The original was up on Mount Scopus, yeah. Yeah, and then after 48, when there was no access, they went and, you know...
Ankara.
Yeah.
Right.
Correct. And the beautiful stained glass
they
windows.
They just built
this
building that they can't pay for.
Right.
Last year.
All right. Where were we? Okay. Eventually, she also founded a medical school, dental facilities, x-ray clinics, infant welfare stations, soup kitchens, and more. And the goal was to bring American efficiency and resources, not just dollars, to the operation of medical relief in Palestine. And the British were just fine with this. After the British came around 1917, 1918, they were very happy to have the support. It was something that they didn't have to worry about. In 1920, after going back and forth to Palestine for a number of years, she arrives for good. Now, she's also going to spend in the 20s 3 years back in the States, but her main residency is in Palestine at this point. She comes principally to oversee something called the American Zionist Medical Unit, which again is the nucleus of the hospital. She's elected to the 3-person executive committee that oversees Jewish life in Palestine. We spoke a little bit about that. For the World Zionist Organization. In 1935, she fulfills a goal and opens the School of Social Work at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. So she's the one who does that. Her last great effort was Youth Aliyah. Anybody know what Youth Aliyah is or anything about it? Youth Aliyah began in 1933, and the goal was to bring German Jewish kids in particular out of Germany
to Palestine and helped give them families and adopt them and make sure that they would get their life, you know, going in the right direction. Eventually, she brought 11,000 children over. So she literally saved the lives of 11,000 children, and she went out of her way to try and meet every single ship of these kids who would come. In fact, in one very, very poignant moment, I think, this is her obviously with...
Well, how was she arranging for that? She was negotiating. I mean,
yeah, yeah, you negotiate with the Germans. Remember, the Germans still had relations with the British, so there were German consulates in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. Remember, they were flying the Nazi flag. And remember, there was that Ha'avara, the transfer agreement
right,
as well.
Right, this seemed to be different from that.
It's
right?
A little different. This is more humanitarian. Oh, actually, it's not more humanitarian. We'll get to what she said. I'm going to come back to that. This is a very poignant moment. When Henrietta Soule dies, a youth Aliyah boy from the year or so before, she dies in 45, so it's actually a few years later, a youth Aliyah boy says Kaddish at her grave for her. And I think that's one of the more touching scenes that I've seen in Zionist history. And that's a very famous photo. She didn't go out of her way to be a feminist in terms of what she had to say often. She didn't get involved in those fights. She was a doer. She was... When her mom died in, let me get the year, in 1916, a childhood friend wrote to her and said that he would be happy to say Kaddish for her because she couldn't do it. In traditional circles, a male will say Kaddish for a female. So she had this to say. I know well and appreciate what you say about the Jewish custom, and Jewish custom is very dear and sacred to me. And yet, I cannot ask you to say Kaddish after my mother. The Kaddish means to me that the survivor publicly and markedly manifests his wish and intention to assume the relation to the Jewish community which his parents had, and that so the chain of tradition remains unbroken from generation to generation, each adding its own link. You can do that for the generations of your family. I must do that for the generations of my family. So she said, I might not be a rabbi, but that doesn't mean I'm not going to say Kaddish, no matter what anybody says to me. So, you know, it's tough to decide for me. I've never quite figured out what's feminist and what's this is just who I am. You know, how do you decide that? And clearly, she wasn't going to take a second seat to anybody, but she also wasn't going to challenge certain preconceived rules of society. Her legacy. By the way, that is cited in the conservative movement's Committee on Law and Standards decision as to why women can say Kaddish. Henrietta Soule's response here.
Now, was Ohev Shalom reform at that time?
When she was growing up, it wasn't reform.
No,
it was Orthodox, but her father was very reform-minded.
Yeah, okay. So she had a more traditional education.
Correct. So, here's summing up the Jewish Woman's Archive on Henrietta Soule. In her life and career, Henrietta Soule posed questions and faced challenges that Jewish women in North America and around the world continue to explore. Soule spent little time fighting for women's rights or pleading women's grievances. Yet, in following what seemed to her duty, she proved the power of women's activism. When she finally realized that she could never give full expression to her energies if she stayed within the sphere allowed her within male-led Jewish organizations, she founded one of her own. And the members of Hadassah took up the challenge, raised and modeled by Henrietta Soule, showing that Jewish women could indeed change the Jewish world. I thought that was a nice summing up. You know, you're not going to allow me to do what I want to do with an organization? Fine. I'll go find my own. Her legacy. Poetically, perhaps, in 45, she died in Hadassah Hospital in the Henrietta Soule Nursing School. Kibbutz Kfar Soule is in the Upper Galilee. An illegal immigration ship was named the Henrietta Soule. There are schools and institutes all over Israel named for her. And in a place called Baltimore, in a neighborhood called Colonial Village, there's something called Soule Drive. And I passed it once before.
there's another one.
Yeah?
Yeah, not too far from the shopping center, near Marnat. It connects to Marnat.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Like the street right behind it.
Hmm? I didn't know that at all. All right, now we're going to get to another fascinating woman, a woman named Manya Shochet, or Shachat.
Can I mention, is she the first American that we've discussed as a Zionist? I mean,
she's the first one who was born in America that we've discussed. We've discussed some like Golda Meir, who lived in America.
Raised in America, but...
Yes, she's the first pure American that we've discussed.
So Golda, if she's, you know, American-raised, then two American-raised, and both are women, of all the people that we've talked about.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. The vast majority coming from Russia, obviously.
Yeah.
But Henrietta Tsold, her father, Benjamin Tsold, by the way, was the first Orthodox rabbi in this country. And he came from Germany. Germany or Hungary? I have to look. It might be Hungary.
His picture, Rabbi Tsold,
yeah.
In the Jewish Museum now, the exhibit on Jews in the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
So when you walk in, they have several rabbis, and one was the abolitionist, one was pro-slavery.
Right.
His hat is there.
Wow, the mitre hat, it's called.
Yeah,
it's a mitre.
Yeah. But apparently he was sort of, when you say liberal, he was in between pro and against slavery.
A good rabbi, really trying to meet the needs of his congregants. You're not going to win in Baltimore. Well, Einhorn, they threatened to tar and feather him, so he had to run out of town to Philadelphia.
And Illaway, who was from Lloyd Street,
mm-hmm.
he left there. They each left there for about a year.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting thing. I hear that's a very good exhibit. I read about it, but I haven't seen it yet.
It's closing this month, and you should all go there.
Okay.
It's terrific. Matter of fact, Sunday there's a good lecture on something called Kaddish for Lincoln.
Oh, really?
Some professor. Yeah, 1 o'clock.
All right. I'll look on their website. Yes, ma'am.
Hadassah. At least at one time, was one of the largest women's organizations in America.
Jewish or non-Jewish?
Yes, and they had, I always felt they had political clout because of that, and they did.
Yeah.
That it was important to be a member, even if you were not active.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Hadassah is actually...
Bernie Madoff fixed them.
Yeah.
Yes.
Hadassah did one of the smartest things a Jewish organization has ever done. My daughter, who is now 15, is a life member of Hadassah. Because when she was born, my mother paid $250 for a life membership. Right. Right. So because of that, Hadassah can say they have X amount of members.
Yeah, all my daughters in law.
Yeah, right. It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. You know, and $250, you know, by the time my daughter's 50, that turns into real money.
Now
right?
Men can be members. Yeah.
Affiliates. They call them affiliates, not actual members.
Okay. I worked for B'nai B'rith when they decided to accept women, and it ripped the organization in half in the mid-'80s. All right, now we're going to get to a woman named Manya Shochet. She was born in 1879 in a small Russian town. She was a really interesting woman. Middle class, which was unusual, but her mother was secular and her father was traditional. So she was both exposed to a lot of ideology and there was a lot of tension in the home. She was the eighth of 10 children. Her brother Isaac went to Palestine in 1882 with the Bilu group. And his letters home greatly influenced her, so she was Zionist too. So she was traditional, secular, and Zionist at the same time. At age 15, she ran away from home to become an industrial worker in her brother Gedalia's workshop. But in the next year, she went and led a strike against her brother for the horrible working conditions and the long hours and the low pay. So this was a family, as we say, that had some issues. I've seen it spelled both S-H-O-C-H-E-T and S-H-O-C-H-A-T. So, but her first name is Manya. How do I have it up here? I have it C-H-E-T, but like I said, I've seen it both ways. She was arrested for working for the Bund, which was the Jewish socialist group in Eastern Europe. Remember, this is in the Russian Empire. She was released, and she founded a Jewish group called the Jewish Independent Labor Party. Now, the Jewish Independent Labor Party was very interesting because it had the permission of the head of the police to operate, as long as it wasn't involved in revolutionary works. And that worked out very well for a while, but then the interior minister, a notorious anti-Semite named Plebe, didn't like the man who was giving Manya Shochet permission to run this group, which had become very popular, so he shipped him away and cracked down on her group, and she became a revolutionary. She started smuggling guns for her group. In 1903, the Kishinev pogroms changed everything for her, just like it changed things for Bialik and it changed things for so many others of this generation, the cruelty and the devastation, the shocking nature of what had happened. The next year, she went to Palestine to visit her brother Nachum. And she traveled all over the place and she fell in love with the place. Now, the reason she went to visit her brother Nachum is because he sent her some letters encouraging her to come because he knew something that she didn't know. Her associates, for whom she was smuggling guns, were about to be arrested by the Tsar's police. And indeed, when she got back, when she went to Palestine, she later found that out and she realized that she couldn't go home anymore. She came to two conclusions after touring the land, that what were the 22 or 24 settlements at that point. The land needed a large Jewish working class, and it needed collective agricultural settlements. So she was bringing in the second Aliyah socialist mentality over with her. She went to Paris to convince none other than Baron Rothschild that what he needed to do was make sure that at all his settlements, Arabs weren't guarding the land because they were ripping off the settlers, that it should only be Jews. While she was there, she met with a friend from Russia who was also there to persuade the Baron to give him money so that he could buy weapons to help Jews defend themselves in Russia. She really liked this idea. So she started smuggling weapons for these people.
She liked her guns.
It was a woman who liked her guns. She would disguise herself as a rabbi's wife and smuggle guns into Russia. An undercover police agent came to her apartment in Russia, knocked on the door and said, "Can you give me refuge? I'm hiding from the police." And she let him come in and she started talking to him and she realized that he was an undercover agent of the police. So she shot and killed him. So she had a couple guns lying around the house. She went back to Palestine in 1906. The next year she became one of the founders of the farm at Segera, which is S-E-G-E-R-A. We talk about Kibbutz Degania in 1909 being the first kibbutz. Segera was an experiment for a year by the Zionist organizations to see if there could be a kibbutz-like operation, and it succeeded. She met her soon-to-be husband there, a guy named Israel Shochat.
Sure, his name wasn't Clyde.
Well, she's not done. In 1908, she was one of the founders of Hashomer, which was the Jewish Defense Organization. And that's the year she married Shochat. And there were some riots in 1921 in the country, so we know what she did. She didn't smuggle guns. She got smarter. She smuggled grenades.
They cleaned that up a lot in this book.
Yeah, yeah. She's a great... I wish they would make a movie about her life. The stuff I read about her was absolutely fantastic. It was a great story. So in 1921, she went to the United States to raise money for Histadrut. But she really had a secret mission. She was raising money for something else.
Weapons.
You got it. And again, highly unusual for a woman in this era to be doing this type of thing.
Well, she was an expert. What other woman knew as much as she did?
Exactly.
Well, she could get away with it.
She, every time somebody was assassinated, they suspected her. You know, they suspected her of involvement. But yet, this is the really, it's all interesting. In 1930, she was one of the co-founders of the Jewish-Arab Friendship League. And she would go on to be involved in the binational state movement of Martin Buber and others. So she believed in coexistence at the same time. You know, one hand does this, the other hand does that. All right, so I'm going to go through one more woman tonight for us. So if you ever get a chance to read about Manya Shochat, and there's a great article in the Jewish Women's Archive on her. There's a couple others you can hunt around and find too. And there's, I didn't find any books that were here in the States. There's a lot of stuff in Israel that's on her. A lot of dissertations, or some dissertations. All right, our final woman.
Page 3 to 12.
Yeah.
All right, our final woman of the night is Rachel Yanait Ben Tzvi. That's her here in her later years when she is married to the president of Israel, Yitzchak Ben Tzvi. She had a very romantic view of life in Eretz Yisrael. This is in the preface to her book. This is the classic Zionist ideology that we've come to expect. On her first trip, when she goes around with the man who's going to be her husband, we went up to the Galilee, down to the Negev, roaming about for weeks in the desolate expanses, sleeping in the fields and filling our lungs with the air of the homeland, envisioning and dreaming about the future of our nature in the homeland. We prayed in our hearts that we would be entitled to revive it by working and protecting it. I recall the wonderful feeling that accompanied me when visiting each historical site, the wonderful feeling of being born again in our homeland. Now that is great propaganda. That is right out of the propaganda poster that we started with at the beginning of the evening. But she was no easygoing person, as you might not be surprised to learn. A little bit of biography first. Born in 1886, lived a nice long life, lived until 1979. Was from a Hasidic family in a Ukrainian shtetl. Lived in her grandparents' home. She heard of her grandfather's longings for Jerusalem, very sad, and her grandmother's Hasidic tales. She was an intellectual. At age 15, they moved to Zhytomyr, and she went to a gymnasium, the secular high school there. Her parents said that was okay. There she developed a love both for botany and for Zionism, and later in life, she would write books about both. After her husband died, she went and authored 10 or so more books. In 1906, she helped found a local chapter of Pohel Etzion. We talked about that. That was one of the groups that became a political party in the land of Israel. In Palestine, in 1908, she emigrated to Palestine. She settled in Jerusalem, and she became a founder and teacher at the Hebrew Gymnasium in Jerusalem. So she was a teacher as well. In 1909, she participated in the founding of HaShomer, which we just talked about with Banya Shochat. So there were several women involved in that. In 1911 to 1914, she traveled to France, where she studied agricultural engineering. And back in Palestine, she worked on Aharon Aronson's agricultural station, an agronomist station at Atlit. Does anybody remember that? That was the Neely group from World War I that were spying for the British. So she was involved with that.
Our creator shall not lie. The Lord and our God creator. That's
a bet. What, Neely?
Yeah. That means
Netzach not, Yisrael will not rest. Netzach Yisrael lo yishkor.
Will not rest.
Yeah. Lo yishkav. Will not lie down. That's right. Lo yishkav. Alright, where is it? Okay. Somehow she evaded capture, unlike many other people at that time. After the war, she met and married Yitzchak Ben Tzvi, I spoke about. Unlike most, she had a parent and two sisters who came to Palestine. So her family followed her to Palestine. She said she wasn't a feminist. She actually came out and said that, but she sure sounded like it. She simply said that she believed talented women could rise to outstanding achievements, and women should demand equal work, pay, and training. That's not a feminist, right? I don't know who she was fooling. All right. 1925 to 27, she helps establish the Zionist Pioneer Women of America in Canada. She was one of those people who looked to cultivate the diaspora for more support. That was a sister organization to the Moetzet HaPoelot, which we already spoke about tonight. And she helped them raise funds to build houses for women in Palestine, and particularly at some of these farms that we were talking about as well. She became one of the heads of the Haganah in Jerusalem. She's believed to be involved in the assassination of Jacob de Haas. Some of you may remember him as the Dutch poet who became ultra-Orthodox, and he was the foreign minister of the Haredi community. We spoke about him. She helped set up women's worker conventions. And after the War of Independence in 48, she helped establish the Agricultural Youth Village for immigrants. When her husband became president in 1952, she took a very active role as a first lady. At his death, she set up Yad Ben Tzvi, which is an institute, where she led a lot of the research and publications on the history of Eretz Yisrael and the ethnic heritage of Sephardim and Eastern Jews. Not a lot of people had paid attention to that. She was very fascinated by the Jews who were coming from all over. She authored 10 books and edited 6 more and published 500 articles. And in her own right, she was a significant individual. So I want to take a moment and sum up. Women had a very important role to play in the yeshuv. Sometimes because they did it as women, and sometimes because they were just in the yeshuv. Now, men never had to face that issue, right? They didn't have to face the issues that women faced. They had equal rights or the right to do whatever they wanted to do. So there was an extra burden on them. But clearly, there were examples of women who were role models and inspiring and left their mark. So it's hard for me to say that there was a big feminist movement, because again, I'm a little uncomfortable with the terminology. But after the women finally received the right to vote in 1927, it was a lot easier, although it still wasn't easy in many regards, just like in other Western countries, for them to achieve. But they achieved significantly, and they left us very candid records in this book, The Plow Woman. I've never seen a collection of writings by men that were similar to that. I mean, it's very impressive. So that's it for tonight. Thank you.
That was a fun one to research.